WBAI New York and on the internet at WBAI.org. The program you just heard, Labrish with Haptah Selassie, will be back next week at 2 following the work of the Midnight Ravers. It is 5 o'clock and time for Back of the Book. Hang in there.
Hello, this is Radio's Uncle Sidney. When I'm out and about, folks comes up to me and says, "You should be ashamed." But when they calms down, they says how much they loves WBAI. That's WBAI New York and WBAI.org. Back in the day, we had commentaries by Malcolm X, Ayn Rand, Abby Hoffman, and William F. Buckley Jr. Imagine them folks in the same room at the same time. Nowadays, we've got Bob Fass, the founder of the Feast. Amy Goodman, you know her, we got her. Michio Kaku, the smartest guy in the world. Shows that helps you not to get evicted. Top-of-the-line news and interviews. Insane artists and musicians. Well, okay, okay, we went nuts for a while back there. But now we're okay. We're like your crackhead cousin that's making good. So we know you're pulling for us. Go, go, run right now to WBAI.org and look around. See where we've gone. You can even subscribe online. Believe me, you'll be glad you did. Stay tuned.
It should be about 5 a.m., and you're listening to all...
I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. This may be the last broadcast. The enemy is now inside 5 great machines. They rise like a line of new towers on the city's west side. Now they're lifting their metal hands. This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's 50 feet.
Radio WBAI New York.
No, I know we're not in Kansas.
Good goddamn morning. How the hell are you? This is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio Spickles of the North. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning to you, my dear. And a hearty hello to our dear 19 listeners, wherever they may be.
It's Countess Pickles this morning, I suppose. Anyway, you can find out a little bit more about what we're going to do here by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com, where you can look around at things. When you get there, you'll get a blue navigation frame on the left side of your screen, and at the top it will say Latest Back of the Book Program Links. Click on that link and you'll be at the webpage for tonight's program, for this morning's program. And the WBAI website and the archives seem to be functioning. This is our 64th pandemic episode of Back of the Book. It's pre-recorded. This program was recorded on Friday for airing Saturday morning. So if things have happened between then and when you're hearing this program, we won't be referencing them on this program. A recorded program cannot be as up-to-date as a live program. However, this is what we have to do in these dangerous times. And, of course, the big thing, the top story of the world of the past week. We are holding at 116 followers on Twitter. Oh, it's so tremendous. Everybody is standing in the street being amazed at that huge number. The next public WBAI local station board meeting is scheduled to be held on Wednesday, November 10th, 2021 at 7 p.m. on Zoom, even though Zoom compromises privacy and security. And that will be the final meeting of the 11th WBAI LSB. The 12th WBAI LSB will be seated on December 8th. And I don't know, some people may get confused about that because in a couple of days, on Monday, November 1st, the National Election Supervisor is scheduled to release the information about what happened in this election and who got elected and who didn't get elected. And that'll certainly affect things. And those people who are elected about will comprise about half of the 12th WBAI local station board. Yeah, they started in 2004, and we're at the end of the 11th one, and we're going to start the 12th one on December 8th. That's when people get seated, not before then, so I hope we don't get confusion from people who don't pay attention. Program note, we are preempted next week. That's November 6th, and we're preempted for a fundraising special. So we will not be on then, but 2 weeks from now, we'll be back here having all sorts of great fun. So yeah, 2 weeks from now, we'll be back. November 13th, we'll be doing a show again. According to the Johns Hopkins website, COVID-19 cases in the whole world reached 245,893,010, and global deaths reached 4,987,156. In America, the number of cases as of Friday was 45,892,544, and the death toll in America reached 744,955. And these are all the numbers we got on Friday afternoon. So, 10,117 people have died of COVID-19 in America since our last program 1 week ago. And that's down a bit from the previous week. So, we're trending down again. We trended down before, and it went back up. So we're trending down again, and that's a good thing. We're still seeing deaths that are much higher than they had been by the end of the summer. And the holidays are coming, and people are already going indoors more. More unvaccinated people are getting sick, and they comprise most of the deaths. And almost all the deaths, and overwhelmingly most of the hospitalizations. And by the time this program airs on Saturday morning, all of those figures we quoted will be higher. And this was all mostly preventable. Now, there's some news that's coming out. And, you know, we've had all sorts of things, people taking ivermectin and, hydroxychloroquine, and a certain former president suggesting bleach. Well, you know, let him pour some bleach into his lungs. They should have done that for him. Yeah, you're telling people to take bleach here, open wide. Glug, glug. Here's some Clorox for your lungs. Anyway, something has been found that may be having a good effect here. The antidepressant drug fluvoxamine has been getting tested as something to help people to resist COVID-19. It's being reported that the drug has shown promise in keeping people with conditions such as diabetes and hypertension out of the hospital. And the study authors have submitted their results to the World Health Organization and the U.S. National Institutes of Health. And Canadian researchers tested about 1,500 Brazilians who had recently been infected with the virus that causes COVID-19, and they were at risk of severe illness due to underlying conditions. And, of course, underlying conditions could be you're elderly, you have diabetes, you have hypertension, you have cancer, and some other stuff that can be in there. Oh, boy. And or if you're immune compromised for whatever reason. And so they all had some sort of underlying condition, and that makes you very vulnerable to being hospitalized and also to dying. About half the people they were studying took the antidepressant at home for 10 days, and the rest got placebos. They were tracked for 4 weeks. Of the patients receiving fluvoxamine, 11% ended up hospitalized or in the emergency room, while 16% of the placebo group did, which is about a 30% reduction in hospitalizations, which is better. You know, it's 30% reduction, not a majority of it, but 30% is better. I mean, if we look at what we've got here in America alone, we had 10,000 people die in a week. So figure if you don't go into the hospital, you're not going to die. But this is a very rough calculation. And 30% of 10,000 is 3,000. You could end up with 3,000 of the people who died this past week not dying. And that would be a good thing, probably. Anyway, this drug, fluvoxamine, it only costs $4 for a 10-day treatment. And it seems to tamp down the cytokine storm that drives the immune system crazy and does damage to the body. Basically, what happens in a cytokine storm is the immune system is just driven to the point where it does everything. It like declares atomic war on the germs. And unfortunately, this causes some of what the immune system does is cause inflammation. That's actually a part of fighting disease in your body, inflammation. But of course, it can get to be too bad. In fact, we all know about the 1918-1919 flu pandemic that killed just millions upon millions of people, more millions of people than this one seems to be doing. And the main way people died of that was from a cytokine storm because their immune systems kicked into overdrive and just tore them up. And what we see here is blood clots a lot from COVID-19, and people's organs get shut down because of the cytokine storm and basically their own immune system just doing tremendous things to try and fight the disease and accidentally, so to speak, killing them. Anyway. Fluvoxamine is most often used to treat obsessive-compulsive disorder and depression, but it can affect inflammation as well. Study co-author Dr. Edward Mills of McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, he's a professor in McMaster's Department of Health Research Methods, Evidence, and Impact, he said in a statement that, quote, fluvoxamine is, so far, the only treatment that, if administered early, can prevent COVID-19 from becoming a life-threatening illness. It could be one of our most powerful weapons against the virus, and its effectiveness is one of the most important discoveries we have made since the pandemic began, unquote. So this drug that's cheap could save some lives. It's a lot cheaper than monoclonal antibody treatments, and those cost over $2,000 and require a lot of attention by nurses and other people in the hospital. And affordability is really important in some countries and for ordinary people, too. Still, it's best to get vaccinated if you can.
At this point, I should say that this is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. He is R. Paul Martin, and I am Radio's Pickles of the North.
So there was an interesting article in the Science Times, which is a part of the New York Times, of a couple of weeks ago. And it's by Emily Enthes. And it's interesting in that it explores a few things here. And it talks about stuff we've talked about in the past that it says here, with every infection come new opportunities for the virus to mutate, which we've talked about. And, of course, we now have in the world 245 million, it'll be 246 million by the time you hear this on Saturday morning, except it's much more than that because it's not being tracked that well, and some people are denying it. So it's more than it's probably more than a quarter of a billion people who have gotten this so far. And as it says in the article, with every infection come new opportunities for the virus to mutate. And that is the dangerous thing, the virus mutating. And in the article, it says we are extremely unlikely to eradicate the virus. And in the next few years and decades, it's going to be around. And what's going to happen is very difficult for scientists to predict. In this article, it continues and says, the coronavirus could shift in countless ways, but there are three concerning possibilities. It could become more transmissible, it could become better at evading our immune system, or it could become more virulent, causing more serious disease. And, of course, we know the mutations have been happening. We've been tracking them. They've been in the news. And Jesse Bloom, an expert in viral evolution at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, says, quote, the virus is just better at transmitting from one person to another than it was in January of 2020. And this is due to a variety of mutations that the virus has acquired, some of which we understand and some of which we don't, unquote. And in January 2020, the mutations were already happening. And one mutation called D614G most likely stabilized the spike protein that the virus uses to latch onto human cells, making the virus more infectious. And more mutations have sprung up, giving rise to even more transmissible variants. First came Alpha, which is about 50% more infectious than the original virus. And after that came Delta, which was roughly 50% more infectious than Alpha. And they say that getting a hyper-infectious variant, it's just textbook viral evolution, because people have been studying viruses and all for over a century, and they've got some good ideas about how these things do work. And one thing that Dr. Bloom brings up is that at the very least, the new coronavirus cannot replicate infinitely fast or travel infinitely far. So that's working in our favor. It isn't like super. It's not like a science fiction movie. And Dr. Bloom says, quote, whether the Delta variant is already at that plateau or whether there's going to be further increases before it gets to that plateau, I can't say, but I do think that plateau exists, unquote, which means it will reach a maximum ability to be transmissible and then stay there. And so the article continues that the Delta variant is so infectious that it has managed to outcompete and thus limit the spread of the stealthier variants, because there are ones that are sneakier than Delta, but they're not as infectious. And so, I don't know, maybe Delta is something better because these others might sneak in. The doctor says, Our assortment of T cells can recognize at least 30 to 40 different pieces of SARS-CoV-2. That's the official name of the virus. And researchers have found that. So the thing can recognize 30 to 40 different pieces of it. So that's good because that gives it a better chance of latching on and stopping it from doing something. And Shane Crotty, a virologist at the La Jolla Institute for Immunology, said that so far studies suggest that our antibody T cell and B cell responses are all working as expected when it comes to SARS-CoV-2. And, quote, this virus is mostly playing by immunological rules we understand, unquote. And that's a good thing. And that otherwise, we'd really be up a creek if they couldn't understand it. But they understand it well enough to have gotten a vaccine, a set of vaccines out in record time. And they got it out in record time because they understand DNA better and RNA better. And they can do genetic manipulation and crank out something. They can build. They can build something that will stimulate your immune system. You don't have to get blood out of somebody and find the virus and start distilling the virus and then have to worry about is what we're going to inject in somebody going to give them the virus. No, they say, okay, these are the parts of it that are relevant, and they just create those parts in a lab. And it also notes here in the article, unlike transmissibility or immune evasion, virulence has no inherent evolutionary advantage. The virus has no interest in killing us. And, yeah, that's part of the deal. I mean, it's not like the – it's a virus. It's a bunch of biology that's stuck together. Not well stuck together either. And so it's just there. It's a thing. And so it's not hunting us or anything. It's not like a hungry animal. It's just there. And so how it works is all extremely impersonal and not even related to motivation or anything because it doesn't have any motivation. And what happens is it is helped by being transmissible, but by killing us, it doesn't do much for it. So there is that. And the doctors say it's too early to say whether SARS-CoV-2 will change in virulence over the long term. They're, of course, hoping that it will not do so. And some evidence suggests that Delta is more likely to result in hospitalization than other variants. And that's one of the bad things about it, is that it brought quite a bit of virulence along with it, besides its ability to be infectious, more infectious than chickenpox, which is very infectious. One of the quotes in here is that as the number of completely vulnerable hosts dwindles and transmission slows, the virus will have fewer opportunities to mutate. And again, this is because a lot of people are getting vaccinated and a lot of vaccinated people are dying of it. And so it's really going to be mutating in those unvaccinated people. And, you know, if you cull the herd enough, it isn't going to be able to do it as easily. And one quote in here is that we will reach an uneasy equilibrium with the virus, scientists predict. We will never extinguish it, but it will smolder rather than rage. And Jenny Levine, who's an infectious disease researcher at Emory University, says, quote, my guess is that one day this is going to be another cause of the common cold, because we've got like four or five coronaviruses that cause the common cold. And they're annoying, and some of them are worse than others, but they generally don't kill you. And so this one person is saying, yeah, the coronavirus, COVID-19, is going to become like the common cold, and it'll, you know, people will catch it and get sick, but not terribly sick, and it's not going to be a killer anymore. So this is one of the things that we can actually look forward to, I guess, is getting more colds and also not having them kill us. And at the end of the article, they quote Dr. Jonathan Quick, who's a global health expert at Duke University, and he says the future, quote, depends much, much more on what humans do than on what the virus does, unquote. And so that, yeah, that really is it. That's telling us that we need to take charge of things. And, you know, Fluvoxamine is all well and good, but getting vaccinated so that you don't get COVID-19 and you're not producing tons of mutations is the best way to deal with this kind of thing. And as we've all heard, the company Facebook is now the company Meta. It's still Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook. I had been hoping they'd rename it Flat Affect Book, or maybe even Ass Book, or Butt Book. But in order to distract from their current difficulties caused by a whistleblower who's leaked a lot of internal documents showing that Facebook is officially trying to be bad and thereby making huge amounts of money, they are now talking about creating something called the Metaverse. Yeah, Zuckerberg calls it the Metaverse. One person on Twitter tweeted that Meta stood for Mark Evading True Accountability. There you go. And there are lots of things being put up with what META could stand for. And the documents that have been released show that Facebook officially knew that girls and young women were especially harmed by some of the things posted on Facebook and Instagram, which Facebook, now Meta, owns. Facebook also knew that hate speech generated anger and made people stay on Facebook for longer periods of time, and so allowed more advertising to be displayed to them, which, of course, makes money for Facebook. And, of course, Facebook invades your privacy terribly. They just ream out everything. You put stuff up there, you write things, it all goes into machines, and the algorithms pick it out, and they profile you because they know who you are, and they sell big bags of information to the advertisers and law enforcement and anybody else who wants to pay them a penny or two. And, oh boy, you know, a lot of people know far too much about some people on Facebook. That's why I've resisted going onto Facebook, and I'm glad of it. And right about now, I think it's time for us to do a station break. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, broadcasting from a transmitter and antenna atop 4 Times Square, going through a new studio somewhere in downtown Brooklyn and originating in our living room somewhere else in Brooklyn. The program is back of the book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North, and you can find out more by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. You can also go to the official website of this radio station at wbai.org. And today, when you're listening to this live on the air, it's October 30th, which means tomorrow is Halloween. And Pickles of the North has a few things to say about Halloween and the very festive holiday that it is. Take it away, my dear.
Yes, festive and full of death. Well, full of fun and with a sort of a good attitude towards death, I think. First, a little bit about the background. Halloween, of course, comes from Celtic mythology, and it's based on one of the 4 quarter days, which were very important to the Celts, all tied to the agricultural cycle. And the one that happens on October 31st is Samhain. Yes, Samhain.
And here's a little bit about Samhain. Samhain marked the beginning of the Celtic year and was celebrated on the night of October 31st, later observed as Halloween, the Vigil of All Hallows, which is the Vigil of All Saints. Leave it to the Christians to take all the fun out of it.
They co-opt everything.
At Samhain, the veil between the other world and humankind was torn aside. The earth opened, spirits roamed the land, the warrior dead came back to life. Gods and demons walked the dark places, and the forests and bogland shook as their steps released the spirits of the underworld. The air was filled with cries and lamentation. The incantations of ancient priests and druids echoed to the night sky. This was the moment when the cycle of fertility was renewed between the dark time of the year and the light of the new year to come. Fires were lit on the hilltops to guide returning warriors, and the Shi released phantoms and goblins to ride the night winds. Now, the Shi are fairy mounds. They're invisible to humanity, and that's where the gods keep their homes. So, Samhain, again, tied to agriculture, this was the end of the agricultural year, the time when they'd bring the cattle in, be slaughtered, and it was the Celtic New Year. And you had to dress up. You got to fool those spirits because you had all your ancestors coming back to your hut to warm themselves by the fire.
Oh, boy, that could be dicey.
Yes, indeed. So, everyone knows by now, I think, or practically everybody, what did the Celts do? Well, they carved turnips into lanterns. Someone has also said potatoes. I can't imagine. A potato is too small. Turnip, you can get some pretty big turnips. Anyway, it evolved. The Irish came over to North America, and we have the lovely holiday that we have right now, Halloween. And I'm very glad to say that little kids will be running around both today and tomorrow outside where it will be safer for them. They'll wear their masks along with their costumes, and they'll be getting candy and scaring each other and having fun. And even during a pandemic, they'll be able to do this pretty safely, at least this year, because so many of their adults are vaccinated, which is wonderful. But now there is something else that happened 83 years ago today. And it's one of my favorite things.
On October 30th, 1938.
October 30th, 1938. Let me just reach down and get my book.
There she goes.
All right. Now, the book I'm just going to be speaking a little bit about is something called Spooked: How a Radio Play Broadcast and the War of the Worlds Sparked the 1938 Invasion of America. This is a kid's book written by Gail Jarrow. It's published by Calkins Creek, and that's an imprint of Highlights. Did you read Highlights when you were a little boy, R. Paul?
I seem to remember something like that.
Highlights magazine. It's been around over 70 years, so...
Was it printed on newsprint?
I believe it was a magazine. So it was.
Okay.
It was in magazine form, and they. I remember this, and they. I think I even have a copy of Highlights somewhere.
I think I've seen it, but I don't think we got it in school. But I'm not sure. And I remember we used to get something or other along those lines in newsprint, not in magazine paper.
Mm. Yeah, it was not high class, you know, it wasn't durable paper that they did it on. But, you know, you had puzzles and stories and all, things that would interest a little kid, like five-year-old kid or a little older. Anyway, so this is the company that has put out this book. And Miss Jarrow presents the then 80-year-old radio drama, because it was published in 2018, to 21st century kids. She shows them that radio was as ubiquitous in 1938 households as the internet is for people today. I believe she says that 80% of the homes in the United States had a radio. So this was a big, big deal. People got their entertainment and their news from the radio, especially breaking news.
And I'll point out that actual broadcasting of speech only started in 1922. So this is radio like that is only 16 years old at this point in time.
Yes, yes. And the early radios, I think those were the crystal sets, right, where you had to wear little headphones to listen.
Yeah, very early was the crystal set, which allowed you to get on a frequency and hear something. And then it got more sophisticated with super heterodyne and all of that stuff later on.
So with this, the whole family sat around and listened to the radio. And I have confirmation of this from my 88-year-old father and my 91-year-old mother that radio was a big deal in their young lives.
Oh, my parents big. And grandparents, it was a very big deal. It was revolutionary.
Yes.
Because it was the first real mass medium in the world where you could have somebody giving a speech, a political speech a lot of the time, and the whole nation could hear it at once. So everybody got that together. They got the same message, and they got it at exactly the same time. So that was revolutionary. Prior to that, you had to have newspapers and, you know, with interpretation of that. And prior to that, you had to have guys like town criers walking around saying, "And the king says, don't do that."
Well, Gail Jarrow definitely touches on that point you just made. She explains how radio drama is put together and how different factors lead to some people mistaking the play on the air as real news reporting, and how some people in every era believe unreal things are real. And this is why this book is so interesting, that she wrote it for the 80th anniversary, but she wrote it during the previous administration's reign. And what this book really is all about is critical thinking and how it's important to be able to critically think about things. It's important. She talks about how, some of the people were listening. It was a radio play based on H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. I forget. That was written in the 1890s.
1899.
Thank you. And they the Mercury players on the air, they thought that this was going to stink. They thought it was going to be a real stinkeroo. They thought it was going to be boring. I mean, they did a lot of rewrites. I think the man, Henry Koch was his name. He was the main writer. And his assistant, I think her name's Anne Frelick. Let me just check that here. Yes, indeed. They were like pounded stuff out. And they were like, this is never going to work. This is never going to work. I mean, she goes into all these details. It's really wonderful. Orson Welles, of course, famously temperamental. John Houseman, The Rock, in the Mercury players, you know, and the sound effects, which were so wonderful in this play, were done by Ora Nichols, who was the head of the sound effects at CBS. And I had not realized this before that, you know, this was very rare for a woman to have this position. Her husband, I think at this point he might have been deceased. He created a lot of the way people did sound effects on the radio, but she, ran the whole department at CBS. And it just was amazing. Through all the angst that they went through putting this thing together, it was amazing when it was on the air. And also, it was very, very clear that this was not a news report. This was a radio play. However, there were enough people who didn't pay attention to the compressed time. And when things happened, people were going from one part of New York to New Jersey in a couple of minutes. That flew right past them because people don't listen.
Yeah. Also, a part of this is, here we go. Yeah, people thinking that unreal things are real is certainly something we're even dealing with to this day. So it's part of the human condition, I suppose.
Well, part of the problem was, even though they ID'd the show, it was clearly a radio drama. They mentioned that it was at least four times during the show. That's the way it was written about in the newspaper. You know, tonight's show was going to be a dramatization of War of the Worlds. Some people ignored this and went a little cuckoo and ran around. And even people were sitting in some places with their friends listening. And their friends knew, this is the Martians aren't invading. This is a play. And other people saying, oh, my God, what should we do? And, you know, so a few people did that. But then the newspapers, in order to sell more copies, really exaggerated the reaction of people to this play. And then newspapers around the world picked it up and they exaggerated it even more so.
And of course, some people must have read H.G. Wells' original novel and knew it was a novel. And, you know, and yes. Also, as I recall, some of the problem was people tuning in and out, going, looking at other things, and, of course, interspersing rather typical radio of those days with the fake news reports of the Martians are landing, as people would have heard in our opening of this radio program. That sort of got some of them because they just fell into the usual way with the ballroom music or whatever you want to call it. And then the guy interrupting the program to say this, that, and the other thing. Also, 1938 was a scary year.
Yes. She talks about that, too. The other thing is, granted, yes, terrible things were happening in Czechoslovakia. And, you know, there were many dictators doing bad things then, and, you know, war was in the air. The United States was not involved yet, but it was coming. And all people had to do who thought, oh, my God, what's happening here, is to turn the dial into another station. Oh, ordinary news, ordinary programs. This can't be what I think it is.
Well, I don't know. It is possible they could think, oh, this station has the news. I mean, we've done that when we were looking at, on January 6th, we were looking at TV and one channel we were watching said, and, you know, and that's it. And it's his stupid speech is over. That's the end of it. And we're back to our regular programming. And they were not going to cover the speeches in, I guess it's the House when the joint session of Congress was there to certify the results. And so, you know, people got up and started objecting and they showed like one of those and then they faded away from it. And we said, well, let's see if there's another station that is keeping this up. And we got to another station, and instead of the boring politicians, we had this woman who was a reporter standing in front of the Capitol building, kind of taken aback. And she'd been through something, and she said, and there were these barriers here, but the crowd has pushed through the barriers, and they're going up to the Capitol building itself, and so we said, oh, this is something happening here. And, yeah, so one station might not cover something big. They covered it later. But another station might cover something big, especially if it's, you know, things from outer space coming in all of a sudden, which, yeah, really they should have thought this through a little bit. But people are famous for not thinking things through.
Well, that is true, and that's the whole point of this book is that you need to learn how to think rationally, pay attention to what you're reading, pay attention to what you're hearing, and then you can make more rational decisions about it. Some bad things that almost came out of this, people wanted the radio to be placed totally in the hands of the government and have them completely control it. Fortunately, that did not happen. All the stuff, all the complaints to the FCC were dismissed. But may I read you just a couple of excerpts or letters that people wrote? The majority of people who wrote in to the station, to the Mercury Players, to Orson Welles, the Jarrell says the majority of the comments were positive. So it was just a minority of people who were very unhappy. And I probably think they probably felt foolish, too, you know.
Maybe, yeah.
Because they'd have people, their friends, razzing them. So here's some excerpts that I believe they're from, oh, my gosh, I'll just tell you. About 1,400 letters were sent to Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater and they survive in library archives. Less than 10% criticize Wells and the broadcast, because, of course, this was not malicious at all. It was a radio play. It was not fake news. It was a drama. So here's some excerpts from those letters. Perhaps if you'd put on your little play 50 years ago, it would have been a joke. But the way science has progressed in that time, surely nothing is impossible. Scorchingly, M.M., Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. So I guess that's an interesting one.
Earth science going forward means the Martians could be, you know, I guess maybe she has an in on what's happening with Martian science.
He
or she, whatever.
Another excerpt. I think the safest place for you is Mars. Take a rocket and get going. Nuts to you. That's from G.H., San Francisco, California. There was only one thing wrong about the location. Why didn't you set it in Berlin and destroy Mr. Hitler? Miss D.H., Patterson, New Jersey. Well, that's an interesting one. Don't people think anymore? My God, what the propagandists of the next war can do. E.C., Hartford, Connecticut.
They were already doing it. I mean, we know 1938, of course, was quite a year. I mean, the Czechoslovakia stuff that was almost World War II nearly started in 1938 over Hitler wanting, just the Sudetenland, just the outer part of Czechoslovakia, where they had their frontier fortifications and all of that stuff. And also, of course, we had on the other side of the world, Japan was tearing China apart and had been doing so for years in a horrible way. So you had wars going on, plus Italy was bombing Ethiopia and it had taken it over. Yes. And so, yeah, you had a lot of stuff going on in 1938. Yes.
She does a timeline in the back of the book for the kids. And also she talks about different frauds that happened in other years that people mistook as reality. And I'll just read you one more excerpt. All this goes to illustrate the low mentality of the average listener. They do not see one-tenth of what they read. They must not listen to one-half of what they hear. From R.I., East Cleveland, Ohio. And I got to say, I think I'm kind of with R.I. sometimes.
I think studies have shown that, I think it's 25%. We listen about, we absorb information through listening about 25%, as opposed to reading, you absorb better. But listening to the radio, you get about 25% of it. So I guess you're only getting 25% of this out there.
So this is a book. I recommend it. It's a kid's book, but it's a great book. It's called Spooked. And the stuff about Samhain came from Celtic Daily Life by Victor Walkley. And that's from like 1998, I think.
And I think we should point out the spelling of Samhain.
Yeah, some people say Samhain, and that's the way it looks, S-A-M-H-A-I-N. But of course, it's Celtic, so it's doesn't look the way it's spelled. Also, I highly recommend tomorrow you tune in to Max Schmid's Golden Age of Radio, because he's going to do a Halloween Spectacular, and that's at 8 o'clock Sunday evening.
Here on WBAI New York. And the Italian Senate has voted down a bill that would have made anti-LGBT violence a hate crime. Yeah, they voted it down. The bill was opposed by far-right and Catholic groups. It had been passed by the Italian Chamber of Deputies in November 2020, and the Italian Senate got around to killing it this past Wednesday. What happened was that the Italian Senate voted to block debate on the law by a 154-131 margin. So they killed it by 23 votes. This is not too different from when the New York City Council refused to hold hearings on Intro 475, the first gay civil rights bill, as we billed it in those days, and thereby prevented it from coming anywhere near a vote for a long time. So those legislators in the Italian Senate who had upheld bigotry cheered and applauded their having prevented the bill from becoming law. The law would have also made it a hate crime to engage in violence against women and against people with disabilities. A member of the European Parliament named Pina Picierno called the vote, quote, one of the worst pages in the history of the Italian Republic. And that's saying something. The largest pro-LGBT group in Italy is called Arcagay. I think it's called Arcagay. It's spelled that way. And they have said that there were protests over the killing of the bill in dozens of Italian cities, and they predicted that more demonstrations would happen in 42 cities on Friday. And, of course, we're recording this on Friday, so we don't know what's happened. We'll know it. You will be able to know more than we at the time when you're listening to this on the air. The general secretary of Arcagay, they have a general secretary instead of, that's better than like president or spokesperson, I suppose. The general secretary of Arcagay, Gabrielle Piazzoni, is quoted as saying, quote, now is the time for anger. We are reacting to an insufficient and mediocre policy, to the rejection received with applause and shouts from the Senate floor. A shame for Italy. And we are protesting against a parliament that elevates and protects haters, violent people, and murderers. We will no longer be satisfied, unquote, he said. He also said, quote, marriage equality, adoptions, anti-hate laws. We want all and we want it now, unquote. He added that the anti-LGBT vote in the Senate, quote, will return like a curse, unquote, on them. Well, that's an Italian thing. He's giving the old, tooth thing and all of that. He's giving him the evil eye, I think, there. Oh, boy. Yeah, that's an Italian gay curse on them. There they go. I just want to note that during the past week, I broke down and bought a game called Halo. And it's actually six games in the Halo series. And Halo is an old game. It's from years ago. But they've put six of them together, and it was at a very low price. And I said, geez, I want to get that. I played one of them, Halo 2, years and years ago. And I said, let me get these. And so I'm looking at that, and I'm going to waste time on that, I suppose. I shouldn't have done it, but I've done it, and that's life. Ah, Mr. Outro Music has come on. Okay, that's been it for Back of the Book for this week. Thanks a hell of a lot for listening. We'll be back here 2 weeks from now. We're preempted next week, so we'll be back here on November 13th. Coming up next is
Ralph Nader Radio Hour, and then at 7, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund,
which is all about science fiction stuff. And so, it's going to be, it's getting cold, and, you should not fill up too much on that Halloween candy if you go out trick-or-treating, and be careful with all that stuff. And above all, remember what that dedicated to fighting those Martians whenever they show up, Dormouse said.
Winding your way down a Baker Street, light in your head and dead on your feet. Well, another crazy day. Drink the night away. So cold, it's got so many people, but
place. He opens the door, he's got that look on his face, and he asks you where you've been. You tell him who you've seen, and you talk about anything. He's got this dream about buying some land. He's gonna give up the booze and the one night stand.
Listening to WBAI New York. I'm Celeste Katz Marston. This is New York in Crisis, WBAI's coronavirus diary.
My name is Alex. I am originally from Israel. I moved here to New York 2 years ago, and I work for a big tech company doing sales. I was one of the first few people to get sick, and I was at home in bed for a week. And once I recovered, I was contacted by a big medical provider here in New York to come and donate plasma for those who are having a bad time recovering from COVID-19. So I applied online to do so. That's how it all started getting interesting from that perspective. When I filled all those forms online, they asked you all sorts of questions about who you are, where you're from, your age, everything. And I specifically told them that I'm married to a man and that I'm not a U.S. citizen. And they called me to come and donate anyway. And I asked them over the phone if all of my information was okay for me to donate, because I was aware that sometimes gay men were not allowed to donate blood. So I was just making sure that everything was fine. But once I got there, I asked the nurse to make sure that I could donate, because I just didn't want to have my donation go to waste. Like, sometimes they just take our blood donations and throw them to the trash. So they called the head of the program to come over, and she essentially told me that the hospital, like all the hospitals in the city, are subordinate to an FDA regulation that doesn't allow for gay men, that doesn't matter who you are, who have had sex with another man in the last 12 months, to donate either blood, plasma, or anything. So essentially they called me to come over, and then they just sent me back home because of my sexual identity. It was very humiliating, essentially, because all I wanted to do is to give my part and try to help others recover from this horrible thing. And it was really just a reminder of how bad things can still be for minorities and people like myself. I'm an immigrant, I'm a gay man, and I'm very sensitive to how society nowadays just has not only not gone forward and improved things for us, it's actually going backwards. So it was painful. A few days before that, one of my neighbors, a 75-year-old woman, was like, we needed to take her out of her apartment and walk her out to the ambulance. And like, we hear all the time about people dying. There's hundreds of people who die in the city every day. And I just wanted to do my part. And it's very frustrating that I'm not seen as pure enough or clean enough just because I'm gay, and they don't know what my sexual history is. They don't know what my health history is. As a married person, I'm probably way safer than a lot of other heterosexual people would be to donate, and they are allowed to donate, but I'm not, just because I married a man. I don't have words to describe exactly how I felt. It was awful. Having posted about this on social media, all of my friends that reached out to me, people that were completely unaware that that's still the situation in 2020 in America and all over the world, it was a very empowering feeling, having people be empathetic to what happened and being surprised that that's still the case. But more than that, it has empowered me to go out and find other ways to help my community. I've been seeing a surge in people wanting to help each other. And even here in Manhattan, where I live in my building, people are helping the more vulnerable population of the building go and get their groceries or do whatever is needed to help each other out. So it's really nice to see Americans being more community oriented and more family oriented, and